From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with actor Gary Busey about his starring role in the Buddy Holly story, his exhausting fight scene with Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon, and his new movie Point Break. And we'll hear about the motorcycle accident that nearly killed him. Also, we talk with Jody Jacobson of the World Watch Institute about her new report on the state of women's reproductive health around the world. And Ken Tucker reviews Bonnie Raitt's first album since Nick of Time, the record that revived her career. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced today that he's lifting U.S. economic sanctions against South Africa. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Although the announcement was almost anticlimactic due to the administration's leaks earlier this week, it does reverse a five-year policy of sanctions designed to encourage the end of South Africa's apartheid system. Under the 1986 sanctions law, Congress gave the president the authority to revoke the sanctions after Pretoria met five conditions, the latest being the release of political prisoners. President Bush today praised the government of F.W. de Klerk.
Progress has been slow and often painful, but progress has definitely been made. And during the last 2 years, we've seen a profound transformation.
But congressional critics say the president's decision is premature, and they dispute the administration's definition of political prisoners, saying that many remain in South African jails. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell failed today to end debate on the controversial crime bill, but he scheduled another vote on the issue for tomorrow. The bill has drawn strong opposition from gun control opponents because it contains a five-day waiting period for handgun purchases. Debate on the bill has gone on for the past 3 weeks. Mitchell criticized opponents for delaying the $3.3 billion measure and said the only way to deal with the bill was to cut off debate and bring it to a vote. Today's attempt to end the debate failed by just 4 votes. A House subcommittee today held a hearing on the role racial bias plays in death penalty cases. Much of the testimony concerned a new study that says killers of white people are 9 times more likely to be put to death than killers of black people. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
The study, prepared by the Death Penalty Information Center, examines the use of capital punishment in the Chattahoochee Judicial District in West Georgia. According to the report, 65% of homicide victims in that district are black, but in the vast majority of the cases in which the death penalty is imposed, the victim is white. Reverend Joseph Lowry, president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, is one of those calling on Congress to take action.
What we see in practice in some places today is what was once prescribed by the slave codes and the black codes in Georgia and other southern states. The severity of the punishment increases based upon the race of the victim and the defendant.
Reverend Lowry and others are pushing for an amendment to the crime bill that would allow defendants in capital cases to use statistical evidence of racial bias to challenge the use of the death penalty. In Washington, I'm Greg Allen.
Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street after blue-chip stocks slid back from a substantial gain in earlier trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 3 points to close at 2,944.7. On the broader market, advances narrowly edged declines in active trading of 178 million shares. This is NPR. President Bush said today that he intends to nominate Alan Greenspan for a second term as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. The president said that Greenspan's reappointment should be a reassuring signal to domestic and international financial markets. He praised the central bank chief for his skill in keeping inflation under control while stimulating growth. During the recession, the Bush administration has pressed the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates further and faster than Greenspan has been willing to do. An administrative court in France today ruled against the government's controversial expulsion of a prominent Moroccan dissident. Last month, his expulsion provoked a huge outcry among human rights activists. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Moroccan dissident leader Abdel Moumen Diouri had been living in France more than 15 years as a political refugee when he was suddenly expelled last month. The government said he had shady contacts with Libyan and Iraqi secret services and that he was a threat to national security. Badiouri said the real reason behind his expulsion is his latest book, which will be published in France in the autumn and is highly critical of Morocco's King Hassan. Morocco is one of France's closest allies in North Africa, and a week before Diori was expelled, the Moroccan Interior Minister visited France. Today, the court ruled against the government, which it said had offered no proof that Diori is a threat to French security. The dissident can now return to France from Gabon in West Africa, but the government could still try to expel him through judicial means. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
House Speaker Thomas Foley told reporters today that he may decide to order a more formal investigation into charges that the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign delayed the release of 52 American hostages in Iran. He said the formalized investigation would be somewhat like a grand jury inquiry. Up until now, House aides have been reviewing charges that the Reagan-Bush campaign conspired with Iran to delay the release of the hostages until after the 1980 election. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hollywood movies about rock and roll legends are more often than not disappointing. But when Gary Busey starred in the Buddy Holly story, his performance captured something of Holly's originality and energy. It was Busey's first starring role, and it earned him Academy Award and Golden Globe nominations, as well as Best Actor of the Year Award from the National Society of Film Critics. He went on to star with Robbie Robertson of The Band in Carney and with country music star Willie Nelson in Barbarossa. Busey's most successful film commercially was Lethal Weapon, in which he played the nearly invincible villain Mr. Joshua. Busey nearly died in a motorcycle accident in 1988, but after a long and pretty miraculous recovery, he returned to making movies. Now he's starring in the new film Point Break. He plays an FBI agent investigating surfers who he believes are bank robbers. Keanu Reeves plays his rookie partner, Patrick Swayze, a master surfer. The film is directed by Catherine Bigelow, who is quoted in the press kit as saying, "The most exciting thing about casting Gary Busey is that he hasn't played somebody lovable in quite a while." Well, why not?
Well, that's just the range of the exploitation of my energy lately. I came upon a script called Lethal Weapon several years ago and decided I wanted to do action movies. And that's the only bad guy or villain I've ever played. But it was so powerful that people come up to me and say, "Gosh, you play all these bad guys." So Angelo Pappas, the character in Point Break, he is a lovable guy. And he's got such a strong sense of determination, direction, and his objective is so clear to him. He's so target-oriented, goal-oriented, that he will not be derailed, and he does it from his heart. So that's what made him lovable. Also, here's the key. When I'm in a scene and I can't quite find the frequency to come up to the speed that the scene requires, I'll say something that's non sequitur to arrange me in the emotional arena. And I know they can always cut that out and just use what they have in the script. But in this case, they left all my non sequiturs in there. So it made Angelo funny, made him lovable, made him human. And that's what was nice about Catherine. She allowed me that space.
Give me an example of what you mean.
Well, like when I'm telling Keanu Reeves, my partner, about the bank robbers, I'm saying, "These guys vanish. They really get out of here." Well, that was about all the line was. And I couldn't come up with the emotional aspect of it. So I say, "Hey, listen, these guys vanish like a virgin on prom night. They're gone." And things like that. And talking about Calvin and Hobbes in front of a bank stakeout to get myself laughing, which was completely the opposite of what an FBI undercover 22-year veteran of the FBI should be when he's undercover at a stakeout. And he's got this theory that the surfers are the bank robbers, but yet you see he seems like he doesn't care about it. But yet, in contrast, he really does care about it.
Now let's go back to the beginning. You grew up in Texas and Oklahoma. You played football, you played rock and roll, but you also performed in musicals like South Pacific and Bye Bye Birdie. Now what doesn't fit in this picture?
What doesn't fit in this picture?
Yeah, it seems like football and Bye Bye Birdie seem really far apart. You must have had two really different sets of friends.
No, not at all. It was just football was the thing to do in the 50s and 60s when I grew up in Oklahoma. And my dad was an All-American football player in high school and went to the University of Arkansas on an athletic scholarship. And in high school, when I grew up, there were three kind of guys. There were the social giants, the guys who were good with women and who had cars and who had the Madras shirts and who wore English leather. I didn't have that. And I didn't consider myself good looking. I had a big silver tooth and a mouthful of braces. I looked like a Corvette coming at you on Friday night. So I wasn't the social giant. The second guys, they were the hoods. They were the car bugs. They were the guys with tattoos. They made their own gang fight weapons. They wore their hair in ducktails. And they did things to women in phone booths that I didn't know quite what that meant. So I wasn't the hood. The third guy was the jock, the athlete. That's where I have this immense amount of energy that I was given at birth. So I put it into athletics. And I became a football player. Well, I love to tell stories, and I love to be funny, and I love to express my energy. So therefore, I got into plays like South Pacific, like Bye Bye Birdie. I would be playing spring football in college and then go over and study Shakespeare at night and do A Midsummer Night's Dream. So it seems like an unlikely partnership, but it worked very well for me. It works very well still today.
Did you have two completely different sets of friends, though, your jock friends and your theater friends?
Yeah, that's right. That's the way it was in college. There was the athletes, and then there was the guys in the theater. And it was, I went in both worlds.
Did you show completely different parts of your personality to each world?
No, I showed every part of my personality to each world. But each one had different priorities. The football player was the discipline athlete that was not ever going to back down, that was not ever going to get defeated. And I would be knocked down three times in one play and get up and make the tackle. That's what I exhumed myself in. And in the theater, I let my emotions go the same way I let my aggression go on the football field.
How did you start acting professionally?
I studied classical theater for the 7 years, from the Greeks to Pinter, Ionesco, Samuel Beckett, William Shakespeare, Ben Jonson, Christopher Marlowe, Ibsen, Chekhov, Moliere, theater of the absurd, reality, naturalism, Bell Geddes. I studied all that stuff, built costumes, built sets, and started acting professionally. When I went to California, I studied camera technique with a man named James Best, who played Roscoe P. Coltrane on The Dukes of Hazzard. He taught me how to work in front of a camera and how to mesh my personality and my energy on a movie set. So I started professionally in 1970, and everything just fell like dominoes, one land after the other. And the first movie I starred in was A Buddy Holly Story.
Now, I was thumbing through one of these bios of you in contemporary theater, film, and TV. And there was a little quote in this short bio, and it said, "I was the last actor to die in Gunsmoke." You were on the very last episode of the series?
Yeah, that was the last one they showed in March after 18 years, and they picked my show to run, myself and John Beck. And it's funny, it was the story of a bronco buster who broke the spirit of the horse, and as he was riding in the corral, the horse threw him. He got his stirrup caught. He got his foot caught in the stirrup, and he smashed his head against a fence post, and he died of a head injury. And this very thing happened to me years later on a motorcycle in 1988, December the 4th. But I was the last guy to die on Gunsmoke. In my death scene, I died with my eyes open and one eye crossed. And when they saw the rushes, they said, "We can't do this on TV. You can't die with your eyes open and one eye crossed." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" "That means we got to reshoot their death scene." I said, "Okay." So I came back and reshot it. And since it was the last show, John Mantley, the producer of the show, came out and said, "Gary, we want you to have something to take home with you as a remembrance of being the last man to die on Gunsmoke." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "It's this." And he gave me the bench that sat in front of the Long Branch Saloon for 18 years.
No kidding. You have that?
I have that in my home, yeah.
Wow. I know some people who'd love to have that.
Well, don't tell them. Don't tell them a thing. Yeah, it's really nice to have.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gary Busey, and he co-stars in a new movie called Point Break. Now, the first role I saw you in was in the Buddy Holly story. You starred as Buddy Holly. It was a terrific performance. I really enjoyed the movie. And I remember when the movie came out, reading a story about how you were discovered by the casting agent.
Well, Joy Selznick I met when I did the movie Last American Hero, where Jeff Bridges and I were brothers. And Joyce got on my side and started moving me in a managerial way, although she was a casting person. The Buddy Holly, there was a movie called Not Fade Away that was cast by Joyce 3 years before the Buddy Holly story. Not Fade Away, those people didn't have the rights to use Buddy Holly's name. So we got canceled.
What part did you have in Not Fade Away?
J.I. Allison, the drummer. So I lived with J.I. Allison for 6 months, and I heard every story about Buddy Holly there was to hear from his best friend's mouth, J.I. Well, our movie got canceled. 3 years later, the guys from Philadelphia, Freddie Bauer, Eddie Cohen, and the director, Steve Rash, from Texas, came to town. They found Joyce Selznick because they knew Joyce knew where all the Buddy Hollies were. Joyce said, "There's one guy to play this part." They said, "Who?" She said, "Gary Busey." They said, yeah, but he's big and he's blonde and he's not right. And Joyce said, you must see him. But yeah, but we got to see all these other people first. Fine. So Joyce called me and said, come on in and see these people. I said, oh, come on. You can't make a movie about Buddy Holly. This guy is so special and they're going to do it to playback. And she said, no, they want to find an actor to sing. It's going to be the first musical done live. I said, what? They're going to find somebody to sing like Buddy Holly? That's stupid. They can't do that. Well, Gary, would you please do me a favor and get in here and meet these people? I said, okay. So I walked in, and I weighed 175 pounds. I was in the middle of the surfing movie, Big Wednesday. And every story they started telling me about Buddy Holly, I stopped them and said, no, that's not the way it goes. And then I would verify the truth of it. And I said, guys, I'm double parked. I wish you well on your movie. I got to go. Whoop, and I was gone. The next day, they asked me to come in and sing. And I didn't have any lyrics, and they didn't have any lyrics, so I made up nonsense syllables to It Doesn't Matter Anymore and Maybe Baby, and I got the job.
Now, in the Buddy Holly story, you performed real time. It wasn't dubbed after the fact. You weren't lip-syncing to Buddy Holly records.
No, not at all. In fact, that we did it with 4 or 5 cameras, and everything was done in one take, and I sang all the songs in the same key he wrote them in. I didn't see any footage on Buddy Holly, but the people who knew him said, you moved just like him, you sounded just like him, you looked just like him, you had the same energy content. And there were things I said in the movie that weren't in the script that his widow came to me and said, Buddy said that. I said these little things that were, I call them non sequitur, but they happened to be connected to the real guy. And the songs were done fast and quick and without any effort. I mean, the movie was done in 6 weeks for $800,000, and that's pretty fast.
How did the success of Buddy Holly's story change your career and the kinds of roles you were offered?
Well, it absolutely was being like shot out of a cannon over the rainbow. And at that time, I didn't have a manager, and I had an agent that just put me in the next job real fast that was just, oh, my God, it was miserable for me. And I went through about 10 years of a school of experience to get back on the ground, and now I have management, and I have a publicity firm, and I have a wonderful lawyer, and I have a good business manager. So I have a team with me that helps coordinate my energy so that I can be free to perform. And it's something you can't prepare for. You can't prepare for overnight fame and massive success like that, but it's something you got to really relax with and just take a deep breath. And another thing that's come into my psyche is meditation. Meditation is a very effective form of centering myself and getting focused with my inner self so I can control my massive amount of energy. The whole key is balancing your internal energy with your environment and those around you. And that enables you to be more powerful than you think you can be.
What kind of meditation do you do?
It's called Siddha Yoga meditation.
Is it breathing or physical?
Well, it's really a very special kind of meditation. It's kind of a sincerely private situation with me right now.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay.
And it's a very delicate matter, but it is very good. It's very good for me.
When you say that your agent just put you into a role right after the Buddy Holly story, you mean they didn't shop around for the right role, but they just put you in the next offer that came along?
Right. My price bounced from $75,000 to $250,000. So they said, get it, go. And I did it, and it was very hard.
What was the movie?
It was called Fooling Around. And it was with some wonderful people, Tony Randall, Cloris Leachman, Eddie Albert, Annette O'Toole. But it was just fast surface stuff, and I didn't get into the depth of it. And I didn't know how, and I was very green and very young and didn't have any force of management around me to help me persevere that storm that was coming at me.
If you're just joining us, my guest is actor Gary Busey, and he starred in the Buddy Holly story, Lethal Weapon, Carney, and the new movie, Point Break. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Gary Busey is my guest. Let me ask you about your role in Lethal Weapon. And in this movie, you were the real tough-as-nails villain. I mean, in the opening scene you're in, somebody holds a cigarette lighter under your arm for a very long time just to prove how much pain you could take. I trust that's not your arm that they held the lighter to.
Well, what we did, we rubbed dry ice on my arm to take away some of the instant feeling of the fire. And that was my arm, and we had angles where we did the shot where you could take the flame away from the arm a little bit, but I did feel the flame. And that look you see on Mr. Joshua's face is clearly a look of what's happening.
This was your first big villain role. How did you get the part?
I went after it. I read the script and said, "Oh boy, okay." And Tony Howard, my agent at ICM, said they set up a meeting, and they found out they'd already cast the part. So they called back and said, "We can't see Gary." And Tony Howard said, "You set up a meeting with him. You've got to see him. That's ethical and that's right." My attorney, Jake Bloom, went into Joel Silver and said, "Joel, look, see Gary because he's on the money for this." And they said, "Okay, we'll see him, but he has to read." Well, I hadn't read for a part in 12 years. That doesn't bother me. So I said, "Sure, yeah, that's what James Best taught me to do, Cole read well." So I said, "Sure, I'll read." So they gave me 5 pages of a real strong scene, the scene where I torture the Gibson character. And I went in and read it. And they said, "When you finished reading, the hair was up on the back of our neck." So we paid off the person we cast, and we cast you.
Oh, that's interesting. There's a fight scene at the end between you and Mel Gibson, and this is just a hand-to-hand combat kind of scene. And the fight goes on for a really long time.
Yeah.
And it would be humanly impossible for any person to take as much punishment as you're administering to each other. Did the fight ever get to seem almost funny and absurd after a certain point? You must have been shooting it a really long time.
We shot the fight 5 nights from 5 p.m. to 5 a.m. Mel and I trained for 6 weeks, 1.5 hours a day with 4 martial artists to choreograph it. Bobby Bass choreographed the fight. The martial artists choreographed the moves. Mel and I went full speed with each other at 20-second intervals, and we did it for 5 nights. And it was the most, it's one of the scariest things I've done. But and one funny thing, Mel and I never hit each other, but we came within micro inches of our faces, and we were going full speed. So we're very proud of that. And it was something we were doing in November. And it's very cold in Burbank in November, especially with those raindrops hitting you. They aren't raindrops. It's water coming out of a fire hydrant. They're about 3 inches long and about a half inch wide. And they're hitting you like bullets. And Mel and I would have to lay down in our marks, and we'd just hold on to each other, shivering until action, and then we'd go full speed. And we'd hold, he had a great method of, we'd take a tablespoon of blackstrap molasses and hold it in our mouth for 2 minutes, and then swallow it, and then tap on our temples real fast and take 25 vitamins. That was like every 3 hours. And that kept from the middle of your chest up to the top of your head warm.
Did you catch a cold or anything afterwards?
No. No. It's amazing. I think everyone else did, but we didn't. And we were the ones sopping wet going full-speed combat.
Huh. Gary Busey is my guest. I want to ask you about the motorcycle accident that you were in.
Good. I'm glad you are.
It was, what, late 87 or 88?
December 4th, 1988, I hit the concrete going 45 miles an hour without a helmet. And when I came out of the hospital, the California Motorcycle Association got me in front of the press and said, "Listen, go up there and say, you know, helmets are okay, but you believe in pro-choice. You believe in pro-choice, and helmets aren't necessary. You like to feel the wind in your hair and the rain in your face, and you like to see the sun and smell the nature, smell the trees. Go say that to the press." And I'm going, "Okay, fine." Well, I was still in recovery at that time. I wasn't quite in sync in my brain, and I was going through a form of dyslexia. And also the helmets, I didn't like them at that time. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, couldn't feel the wind, and it was a blocking aspect. So I said no to helmets. Well, my girlfriend, Belinda Bauer, she was on my back about this. She said, "What are you doing? You just almost knocked your brains out on the concrete, and here you're saying you don't believe in helmets." And I'm saying, "I'm believing in pro-choice. I think you can wear your helmet or not wear your helmet." She said, "Gary, look at all the children that are looking up to you. Look at all the people that sent you cards and mail and flowers and letters and love." And I said, "Yeah, I know." But finally, I had a premonition. I said to myself when I was flying back from New York to L.A. with Belinda, I said, "I just had a feeling." She said, "What?" I said, "I had a feeling I got a letter." And it said, "Dear Gary, Johnny loved you. He loved Lethal Weapon. He loved Buddy Holly. He loved Insignificance. He loved DC Cab. He loved everything you did. This, that, blah, 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 blah. And like you, Johnny didn't wear a helmet. And we're sorry to tell you Johnny's dead." And I said, "My gosh, what am I doing? I don't want to get that letter." So I changed my stance. Now I'm backing the mandatory helmet law. They wear helmets when they play football. They wear helmets when they ride bicycles. They wear helmets when they steeplechase. They wear helmets when they go into construction zones. You get on a motorcycle and go 85 miles an hour down the road and you don't wear a helmet, there's only one word that equates to, and that's stupidity. So therefore, the helmet issue is very, very, very strong in my course of action these days.
Do you still ride motorcycles?
Yeah, I have my Harley-Davidson.
What's the fastest you'll drive now on a motorcycle?
The fastest I'll drive?
Yeah.
Is the regulated speed.
Right.
Why go, I mean, the regulated speed in California is 55 miles an hour and 65 on some of the open roads. But still, you got to be so sharp defensively. You got to keep every rearview mirror in your eyesight when you're riding in traffic. You got to stay in the left tire lane of the tire in front of you. That's the driving wheel. That's the lane that doesn't have the oil, the sand, the water, the silt. That's the friction tire. The space between the tires is oil and the sand, and that motorcycle has no relationship with those things.
What do you remember of the accident?
Nothing. I don't remember 4 weeks of my life.
Oh, really? The 4 weeks after the accident, you don't remember? You had temporary amnesia.
Mm-hmm. No, I had temporary unconsciousness. I had complete unconsciousness. I mean, I wasn't out. I was up and moving and around. They kept journals on me. I know what I did, which is pretty silly. But they kept the journals, and I can read those and see what I did. I can see the vision of what I did by reading the words. I had temporary amnesia from, like, January the 8th to the end of January, when I was just kind of vague and foggy on everything.
How did you get your memory back?
I don't know. It just seemed like I woke up on January the 8th and I had a burr haircut in my pajamas walking around and going, what's going on? What happened? Said, you're in a motorcycle wreck. Oh, yeah? Oh, really? Oh, wow. What? I had no idea what had happened to me. I don't remember. Didn't remember.
Were you aware of your memory slowly coming back? Did it suddenly come back all at once? What was that?
No, it was a slow process. It's a very slow process. They say you go through four stations in a head trauma that's severe. The first one's agitation. That's when I would throw nurses 10 feet through the air because I didn't want them touching me. The second one is denial, where you're saying, I'm fine, let me go home, I want out of here. The third one is depression, where you go, whoa, what happened? Oh, my gosh. The fourth one is acceptance. And I didn't get to acceptance until April 15th the following year, and that was Easter. That was the day of the Christian resurrection of Jesus. And I realized what it is like to come back from the dead. So I was going, wow. So that's when I started accepting what I went through, and that's when I started externally healing with a conscious mind.
Are there any permanent physical effects?
No, none that I know of. No. No, short-term memory sometimes, I work on that, and I have a photographic memory, so that came back. So everything was okay, and doctors consider me a bit of a miracle.
How did you get back into acting again? When did you think you were ready, and were you ready when you thought you were ready?
No, I wasn't. Yeah, I was ready when I thought I was ready, because I thought I was ready. And I came back into acting. The first show I did was Neon Empire, a Showtime movie about Vegas in the 30s. And then I did My Heroes Have Always Been Cowboys. And then I did Predator 2 and Point Break, and then I just finished a show with Dolly Parton. So it's been a recovery time that's been pretty efficient, pretty quick, considering the scope of my injury.
When you started to act again, did you feel that you had to prove to other people in the industry that, in fact, you were healed and, in fact, you could act again?
Yeah, and to myself as well.
Was that hard to prove?
No, I just did it. I did it to the best of my ability, but I wasn't completely there. I wasn't completely focused. I wasn't completely, didn't have all my motors running, but I was there. The engine was running, but it was a little out of tune.
Is there a direction you're particularly interested in heading now in your acting?
Yeah, romantic comedy, drama, substance, the deepest part of me being revealed so that I can give somebody a vision of how to get out of what they're into or how to come into what they want to be. Just by giving a performance that is truly from my heart and the purest level. Yeah, romantic comedy, and I very much want to do that. That's what I'm going to do, and work with directors who can take my energy and put it on another level.
Well, good. Well, I wish you the best, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
My guest has been actor Gary Busey, and you can see him in the new film Point Break, which also stars Keanu Reeves and Patrick Swayze. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
A nice round of applause for Mr. Buddy Holly.
Oh, well, oh, well, oh, well, a little thing is what you say and do. Make me want both to be with you. Red bomb is a crazy feeling, and I know it's got me really when you say you love me, just wave my heart.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. According to Jody Jacobson, in countries throughout the world, the medical needs of women are being compromised because of social attitudes toward women and sexuality. Jacobson is a senior researcher at the World Watch Institute. Coming up, we discuss her new report, Women's Reproductive Health, The Silent Emergency. And after a long career, Bonnie Raitt finally hit it big a couple of years ago with her album, Nick of Time. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Raitt's new album, Luck of the Draw. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has lifted economic sanctions against South Africa. NPR's John Madison reports on reaction from Johannesburg.
In 1986, Congress passed the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act, overriding President Reagan's veto. That law banned all new U.S. investment in South Africa and imposed a range of trade restrictions until the South African government took a set of specific steps to abolish apartheid. Today, President Bush said he was satisfied South African President F.W. de Klerk has taken those steps, and so he lifted those economic restrictions. President de Klerk thanked President Bush and called him a man of his word and a man of courage. The Johannesburg Stock Exchange soared to record highs. In a long telephone call, Bush explained his decision to Nelson Mandela, whose African National Congress disagreed strongly. The ANC said President Bush's action was premature, but it pointed out that the U.S. has retained other sanctions, including a ban on loans by the IMF. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
In the U.S., the NAACP has also criticized the president's decision to lift sanctions against South Africa. The civil rights group said that the move was premature, a reaction shared by African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela. The move has also been criticized by some leading Democrats on Capitol Hill. President Bush has announced that he will reappoint Alan Greenspan as chairman of the Federal Reserve. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Greenspan's reappointment does not come as a big surprise, but there had been uneasiness in the financial markets about differences between the Bush administration and the Fed chairman over how low interest rates should go. That uneasiness had led to speculation that the president might delay the Greenspan nomination in order to pressure the chairman to lower interest rates even more to spur economic growth. In announcing the reappointment today, Mr. Bush said he believed both he and Greenspan were interested in growth.
I would not be standing here next to Chairman Greenspan and for this assignment if I didn't have full confidence. And that isn't to say that you're never going to have differences between an administration and the Fed.
Greenspan's reappointment will have to be confirmed by the Senate. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
President Bush has approved the closing of 34 military installations as recommended by a special panel. Mr. Bush said the closings that are to be made as a cost-cutting move have his total acceptance. The president signed the papers for the closings and realignments at a closed ceremony with the commission, Defense Secretary Cheney, and other high-level administration officials. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 2 points to close at 2,944.77 in very active trading. This is National Public Radio News. President Bush says that he has no doubts about the ability of Robert Gates to head the CIA. Gates, who is now Deputy National Security Advisor, has been nominated by Mr. Bush for the top CIA job. Yesterday, former CIA official Alan Fiers pleaded guilty to charges of misleading Congress about the Iran-Contra scandal. Fiers has told prosecutors that officials above and below Gates in the CIA knew about the secret diversion of funds to the Contras. Gates had been nominated once before for the top job at CIA, but withdrew his name. On Capitol Hill, a Senate committee has voted to fund the space station by trimming other science programs and cutting some public housing programs. NPR's Richard Harris reports that the cuts to science programs are less traumatic than the House proposed last month.
The House of Representatives wants to fund the space station by slashing nearly $2 billion out of other NASA programs. Many scientists are deeply opposed to this plan because it would be a blow to basic space science. Today, a Senate committee voted to restore some of that NASA funding, though the plan would kill one major science mission, a probe to study a comet, and it would trim other space research, including global environmental studies. Scientists may find this an improvement, but housing advocates won't. As part of this overall plan, the Senate subcommittee proposes cutting funds for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The committee's proposal faces some severe tests in Congress, but today's vote proves that there is still strong support for a $30 billion space station, even in lean budgetary times. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
President Bush says that he believes that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has still not told the entire truth about his nuclear weapons program. And once again, the president said that the United States is very serious about doing away with it. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. According to a new report issued by the World Watch Institute, at least 1 million women will die this year of reproductive health problems. And 100 million other women will suffer from related disabling illnesses. My guest, Jody Jacobson, is a senior researcher at World Watch and the author of the report, Women's Reproductive Health, The Silent Emergency. While there have always been problems surrounding complications from pregnancy and childbirth, this report warns that new threats are on the rise. Threats from the increased reliance on unsafe abortions, the spread of AIDS and other sexually transmitted diseases, and the lack of access to safe contraceptives. Yet, Jacobson says, women's reproductive health problems go largely unnoticed by the world health community. I asked her why.
I think there are a number of reasons. One is that the status of women in most countries of the world remains relatively low if you measure it in terms of income, in terms of education, in terms of political power. And so their problems are relatively unattended to. And also because reproductive health has to do with that set of issues, including sexuality, pregnancy, abortion, that we are usually loath to talk about in the open and that we're slow to move to address things that have to do with these issues. And when we do so, we do it in a simplistic and very political way, as we've seen with the abortion controversy.
What are we specifically referring to when we're talking about reproductive health?
Well, women's reproductive health is comprised of three basic areas, if you will. One is maternal health, and that's primarily determined by complications of pregnancy and unsafe abortion. Maternal health problems are the leading cause of reproductive health problems in most developing countries, according to the data that's available right now. The second category and the fastest growing category of problems are reproductive tract infections, including more widely recognized things like syphilis and gonorrhea, but extending to other kinds of infections like chlamydia and the human papillomavirus, which causes cervical cancer. These infections are on the rise, not only among populations in developing countries, but also within the industrial countries. And thirdly, we have a lot of problems that we're seeing from the inappropriate use of contraceptive methods. Let me give you an example. In Brazil, where oral contraceptives, the contraceptive pill, is available over the counter and without a doctor's prescription, many women who should not be using the pill are using it and using it in under conditions which endanger their health. For instance, many of them are smokers. They're over the age of 35. Consequently, stroke is now a leading cause of death among women of reproductive age in Brazil as related to the inappropriate use of the contraceptive pill. So we have, as I said, the combine of these three factors makes up women's reproductive health and is causing a literal epidemic among women throughout the world.
There's been an emphasis in many third world countries on population control, but has there not been an accompanying emphasis on the women's health?
Well, I think that this is one of the problems, is that most family planning programs have been put into place in order to slow population growth. And so in order to reduce birth rates, contraceptives have been made available. Unfortunately, in doing so, most governments have neither made the information available for which women would use the contraceptive safely, nor have they put an emphasis on the kinds of contraceptive methods women might use, such as barrier methods, which would prevent the spread of infection. And so they've narrowed the options that women face at the same time that they've put pressure on women to have fewer children. This has resulted either in the use of contraceptives that are not being used properly, as in the case I mentioned of Brazil, or in women shunning contraceptives altogether and relying on unsafe and illegal abortions to control their fertility.
Is it possible to estimate how much death or illness is caused by unsafe abortion?
Yeah, it is possible. There are estimates on that. When you look at maternal health specifically, we know that some 500,000 women die each year as a result of complications of pregnancy and unsafe abortion. Approximately a third of those to a half of those are the result of unsafe abortion. So we're looking at about 200,000 or 250,000 deaths each year. Right now, we know, for instance, that unsafe abortion is the leading killer of women of reproductive age in Latin America. It is the leading killer of women of reproductive age increasingly in urban areas of countries like Bangladesh and India, where other kinds of pregnancy-related problems remain very important to women. So we see an increase in the numbers of unsafe abortion, but no one's looking at these problems because of the great political controversy surrounding abortion.
My guest is Jody Jacobson, author of the new report, Women's Reproductive Health, The Silent Emergency. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jody Jacobson, a senior researcher at the World Watch Institute. Are there restrictions on American healthcare aid to countries that have legal abortion, or to clinics in other countries that practice abortion, that perform abortion?
Yes. Now, let me make a very important distinction. The Agency for International Development, which is the channel through which vast majority of funds to these kinds of programs flow, deals with two different aspects. One is health, and that primarily focuses on child health and the eradication of disease like malaria. And the other is family planning, which primarily focuses on contraception and supposedly those programs that would prevent the need for abortion. There is no section of the United States Agency for International Development which deals particularly with reproductive health. And your question cuts across both the family planning and the health issues. However, since it is within the realm of family planning that reproductive health is addressed, if it is addressed at all, this policy, the Mexico City policy, which cuts off to organizations working in other countries any assistance if they are working at all on the issue of abortion, from collecting data to providing services, it does affect clinics in those countries where abortion services might be available to women, or where women might go to get treatment for the complications of unsafe abortions performed elsewhere.
Would you just explain what the Mexico City decision was?
The Mexico City policy is basically a policy put in place by the Reagan administration and kept in place by the Bush administration that forbids U.S. funds going to any group that provides access to safe abortion services, does any research on abortions or counsels for abortions in developing countries, even in those countries where abortion is legal, and that's where, you know, those services are provided by groups like International Planned Parenthood Federation. And so essentially what it does is to say to those organizations, even though you're providing family planning services with our money, because you're not allowed to provide any abortion services with our money, if you're providing abortion services with other people's money, we're still not going to give you family planning money or contraceptive supplies. So many of the organizations that have said, you know, we just won't sign this contract, have had to lose their U.S. funding. And basically that's endangered their programs because they're already short of funding. They need as much money as can possibly be gotten to meet the needs of the rapidly growing needs of women throughout the world for family planning services and information. And so, yes, it has compromised women's reproductive health and probably led to a greater reliance on unsafe abortion than would otherwise have been the case.
So some clinics are faced with the decision of either losing the United States aid or stopping abortion at their clinic.
Stopping providing abortion services, that's right.
Right. Now, in terms of pregnancy and childbirth, considering you're writing about parts of the world where there's very little really good health care to begin with, what do you think can be done to help women's health?
Let's take, for instance, this example of a group I visited in India called Sewa, which in Hindi means service. It's a health group that works in, it's not connected to another Sewa with which people may be familiar, which is a women's trade union organization, but is a health group that works in the Indian state of Gujarat. And their approach to pregnancy-related problems has been to use doctors to train the village midwives, bringing them together on a monthly basis for training and for feedback from the midwives themselves on what their problems are and how they face obstacles within the villages, to train them in techniques that are positive techniques. For instance, many traditional midwives use the traditional practice of cutting the umbilical cord of an infant with any shard of glass or razor or piece of sharp material that might be lying around. Oftentimes, this leads to high rates of tetanus infection, not only in the infant, but in the mother. Similarly, they might not wash their hands before reaching into the vaginal canal to assist in a birth. There are numerous other practices that traditional midwives undertake because this is what they've done for, you know, centuries. By training midwives in appropriate techniques, you can sharply reduce the number of maternal deaths. And this is what Sewa has done in the villages that they cover in the state of Gujarat. So it's a matter both of educating people and offering them access, but bringing health care to them so that it's within their cultural norms, it is an accessible thing. The problem is that it's much more of a private, small-scale approach than it is a government policy. Government policy in many developing countries is to spend upwards of three-quarters of the healthcare budget on urban-based curative health care that never reaches the largest proportion of people in the rural areas. And so most of the people don't even have access. So if we're looking at women's reproductive health problems, the issue really is to turn around, take that money, put it into primary reproductive health care on a level that is accessible to people within their villages, and to remove the obstacles like transportation that so many women face in trying to better their own health and subsequently that of their families.
Do you think your report has anything to say to the United States about its own healthcare system?
Oh, absolutely, because when we look here, we have, again, the issue of lack of primary health care, and we're constantly struggling with spending thousands upon thousands more dollars solving problems than we would otherwise have spent had we addressed the root causes. And this comes back to nutritional deficiencies among low-income populations in pregnancy, as well as, you know, the spread of sexually transmitted diseases, or extending toward other things like coronary disease and so forth. So, yeah, we have to look at primary health care in the United States, too. I don't think it's a prescription that only pertains to poorer countries. It's a prescription that is one that's good for everybody.
Jody Jacobson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jody Jacobson is a senior researcher at the World Watch Institute and the author of the new report, Women's Reproductive Health, The Silent Emergency. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the president's decision to lift economic sanctions against South Africa?
Terry will look into why the president thought this was the right time to do it, on the economic effect it is expected to have on South Africa and on other businesses around the world which may once again decide to invest in that country. We also have a follow-up piece on the Mount Pinatubo explosions in the Philippines and some pieces on controversies, the president's nominee to head the Central Intelligence Agency, the controversy over the civil rights bill, and a new report on the death penalty and civil rights.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Bonnie Raitt has been a presence in popular music for two decades, but it was her 1989 album, Nick of Time, that moved her beyond her loyal cult following, won her lots of awards, and millions of new listeners. Ken Tucker has a review of her new album, Luck of the Draw, which is already in the top 10.
For Bonnie Raitt to go triple platinum and win four Grammys, that wasn't a comeback, that was a revitalization, a rebirth. Heck, that was practically reincarnation. It's also a very tough act to follow. Because if Nick of Time was the first Bonnie Raitt album most people ever heard, then that means an awful lot of folks are thinking of Luck of the Draw as her second album. And you know what that means. After all these years, Bonnie has to beat the sophomore jinx, the time-honored music biz notion that your second album is rarely, if ever, as good as your first. Given the pressure of this dilemma, it's exhilarating that Luck of the Draw is at once so loose and so tight, so confident and so risky, so deeply felt and so much fun.
One of these days I thought we'd get it together. After all, that boy was made for me. But all he left me was a mouthful of feathers. Little bird got free. He always said my love was one-sided. I tried to keep up with supply and demand. There was one way that pie was divided. To pick the
Raitt is working once again with producer Don Was, and she's done something of considerable discipline. Instead of capitalizing on her new prominence and hipness by, say, doing a duet with Madonna or recording a concept album about the plight of the rainforest, she's done something much nervier. She's opted to cut the same sort of album she's been making for 20 years.
All I ever wanted was a love to be true.
Longtime fans know that one way to measure Raitt's confidence at recording time is to count how many songs she wrote herself. By this standard, Luck of the Draw is bursting with self-assurance. She wrote three exceptionally strong songs, including the one I just played, Come to Me. Plus, there's One Part Be My Lover, a sexy doozy co-written with her new husband, actor Michael O'Keefe.
When he looks in her eyes, he sees only the truth, telling him he's been living. Over and over like a line in a song about all
be my lover, one part go away.
On the strength of this composition alone, Michael O'Keefe has already proven himself to be a more valuable rock spouse than Yoko Ono or Linda McCartney. Throughout Luck of the Draw, Raitt's voice is firm and elastic. She used to use frayed vocal cords as proof of authenticity. Now she allows her honeyed graininess to serve as a metaphor for sincerity and endurance. As the album proceeds, a theme surfaces. Here is the testimony of a woman who all her life has wanted more than anything else to be loved for what she is. Now she seems to have achieved her goal, but hasn't let herself become complacent or sentimental. Tough-minded and tender-hearted, Luck of the Draw proves that Raitt is fully up to the challenges of stardom and that luck has nothing to do with it.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
You dust the bottles on the bar counter. You're writing screenplays on the side. 3 nights a week can keep a girl working. Sometimes it's good to lose your pride. These things we do to keep the flame burning and write our fire in the sky. Another day to see the wheel turning, another avenue to try. It's in the luck of the draw, baby, the natural law. Forget those movies you saw, little baby. It's in the luck of the draw, the natural law.
We'd love to hear your comments about Fresh Air, and we have a new listener line for you to call us on, toll free. The number is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. So let us know what you're thinking, what you like, and what you don't. The number again is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Ron Barron, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Turn around and say it's last order.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Merlin Riggs' documentary, Tongues Untied, about being black and homosexual, airs on many public television stations next week. But some stations won't carry it because of its language and imagery. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to Riggs and to representatives of two of the stations which won't broadcast the program. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.